We heard from you wanting more discussion at the intersection of climate change and agricultural practices. This is a listener request hour on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Their mission is to provide dairy industry solutions in a whole bunch of complex areas like food security, environmental sustainability, and economic viability. We're exploring the work of the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center. So get ready for the acronym. It's USDFRC. What are your top concerns about the dairy industry and sustainability? What do you want to know about grazing and best practices for pasture management? How do you think the dairy industry could reduce its carbon footprint? 800-642-1234 to join in. Dennis Hancock is Center Director at the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center based in Madison. Dennis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you started as Center Director and collided with the exact timing of the start of the pandemic, coming in from University of Georgia as a crop and soil scientist department. What was that like to come here and lead the center right at that time?
Well, quite unexpected and quite challenging. Learning everyone's role and their activities and trying to get a feel for what was going on, and then all of a sudden having to direct them to take safety measures to protect themselves and others. Quite a leadership challenge right out of the gate.
Yeah, I bet. What have you learned about Wisconsin's dairy industry so far? What have you explored?
Well, the good thing was I had a bit of foreknowledge of the center beforehand. I had been a stakeholder on the stakeholder committee for about 3 years prior to joining as center director. So I had a little bit of a knowledge of what the center did, as well as the Wisconsin dairy industry. And, you know, I've been in the industry for over 20 years now in total, just not in Georgia or not in Wisconsin. I was in Georgia at the time. So, you know, been to World Dairy Expo and kept tabs with a lot of the scientists up here, and especially here at the center, because those scientists historically have been and continue to be some of the best in the country, leaders in the country. So it's been nice to be able to be part of this team.
How has the pandemic affected dairy farming in our state? What have you seen?
Well, initially we had real major challenges nationally with a lot of producers were having to dump milk.
Mm-hmm.
That was an extraordinary time and very scary, of course. And, you know, the dairy industry prior to that had been suffering for several years of low prices and red ink on their balance sheets, et cetera. So, you know, that was just more challenge to face. And fortunately, many folks were able to weather the storm. And as the pandemic wore on and things shifted in terms of the market, we did see a bit of improvement in price, at least the latter part of last year. Things are settling out back to, the new normal, as we say.
Yeah. We're talking with Dennis Hancock, who's Center Director at the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center based at UW-Madison, looking at the work of the center, environmental practices, the impact of the pandemic on the overall dairy system. With your insights, what questions do you have about the dairy industry and sustainability? Are you concerned about methane production in dairy farms? What about CAFOs? 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Owen is joining us from Waiwega. Owen, hi.
Hi, good morning, Kate. And I forgot the guest name. What is the guest name?
It's Dennis Hancock. Go ahead, Owen. Thanks.
Good morning, Dennis. Yeah.
Good morning.
So as a young beginning farmer here in Wisconsin, you know, these are the challenges that I'm facing. I'll share with you folks. Land access, number one. And I'm watching the larger, subsidized massive dairy farms around me be able to cash flow and quickly gobble up land as soon as it comes available. And then the land that I have available to me are the small parcels, 6 acres, 5 acres, where I can't even get a custom operator, where I don't own the equipment that I need to harvest my crops on time and at the highest quality I can get. They won't even come into the smaller parcels. So then that's basically what I'm left with, you know, the residuals of what the big farms that are taking massive government subsidies to operate, which to me doesn't seem sustainable in the long run. If we have to continue to subsidize an industry, if it's not profitable, shouldn't we allow the whole laissez-faire economic model to take care of some of this need for more and more government intervention? And I think a lot of these farms also, they're, you know, in a certain way, it's a type of foreign policy that's providing a lot of economic gains to citizens of foreign countries.
I just want to pause here on small parcels of land, because Dennis, you've worked with a wide range of farming operations. How do you work with farmers who have these small parcels compared to much bigger operations?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, because like many other businesses, it's especially those based on a commodity, right? A commodity that is openly traded. It's a measure of scale. It's really a function of scale. And we do work with a lot of different producers. You know, and some of the policy things that the caller pointed out, you know, that really is not something that I can comment on, but the research that we do to support, you know, we keep an eye on that from all levels of, or all sizes. I come from a small farm myself, 100 acres of farmland that we are pastures that we would produce off of. And it's a, you know, I have a, you know, personal connection to that, but you know, we really try to make sure that our focus is on what is sustainable. You know, what can we do to increase the sustainability of agriculture? And as the caller pointed out, the economic process of the free hand of the market, you know, that is the American culture. That's our basis. And so we try to focus on a sustainable agriculture that provides for economic profitability on the farm level, environmental stewardship, and things that really enhance the quality of life for those farm families as well. So that's the three pillars of sustainable agriculture, and that's what really guides our research.
Along the lines of sustainable, you led the Sustainable Grazing Systems Program previously at the University of Georgia. And, you know, I understand your nickname is the Grass Man. What are these systems like?
Yeah, so, you know, nationally, about 20% of the dairy industry is what is known as pasture-based dairy. And that usually is defined as something along the lines of 50% or more of the intake of the animals' annual intake would be coming from pasture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very regional, and the systems that are in those regions differ across the country. You know, in the Northeast, for example, there's, you know, much shorter, like here, much shorter grazing season, but very nutritious feed. So the pastures are highly nutritious. In Georgia and Florida, where I worked previously, those pastures generally had a little bit more challenge in terms of nutrition, but they were able to graze 365 days a year. So it's very regional in nature. And as the U.S. dairy forage industry, our Dairy Forage Research Center, we serve the entire dairy industry and trying to provide information for all of those folks. It's an interesting dynamic, and it's been a pleasure to be on a variety of different farms all across the country.
Yeah, and as you step foot on farms in Wisconsin, what are the challenges to sustainable grazing practices in our state?
Yeah, one of the good things that we have had as an opportunity here is we can at least go outdoors and visit with folks. And I've been able to get on to a number of grazing pasture-based dairies in southwest Wisconsin, as well as in central Wisconsin. And, you know, many of them face the same challenges. The biggest problem, of course, is profitability and some of the inputs that are required to operate a dairy, especially the past 6 or 8 months, the input prices have gone completely out of the roof. But the other big challenges, kind of more longer term and perennial challenges that we deal with, are environmental concerns, runoff, making sure that we are minimizing the nutrients that are escaping the farm. You know, the thing about a dairy is that we really strive to recycle as many of those nutrients as possible. Anything that leaves the farm is a loss and an economic loss. We want to try to recycle that as much as possible. So when it comes to grazing, for example, we want to maintain constant cover. We want to not completely defoliate the pasture so that not only does the top growth protect the soil, but the roots are impacted by the grazing intensity. And therefore, the roots also absorb more nutrients. So all of these things are interconnected. And it's not, as I used to tell my graduate students all the time, it's not rocket science. It's harder. It's more complex.
It's a web, yeah. Dennis Hancock leads the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center on the campus of UW-Madison, one of about 90 locations in the Agricultural Research Service under USDA. Farmers, how many cows do you graze per acre? How has this changed over the decades on your farm? What practices are you doing to manage your soil conditions and grasses? Join in. Questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dennis Hancock here in the Ideas Network. We're looking at dairy systems and the latest research out of the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Right as the pandemic struck last year, Dennis Hancock, he became center director, and previously he was a crop and soil sciences professor and forage extension specialist at the University of Georgia for nearly 15 years, where he led the sustainable grazing systems program we were talking about. So with drought and the risks of overgrazing, how do you improve your pasture land? What technologies do you want to know about in dairy farming that could reduce greenhouse gas emissions? Join in, 800-642-1234. Dennis Hancock stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in Madeline now in De Pere. Hi, Madeline. You grew up on a very small Hi. Dairy farm.
Yes, I grew up on a very small, very small dairy farm near Seymour. Actually, it was on the Oneida Reservation. And these big farms with hundreds of cows, I think it's harmful to our environment. It's harmful to our country. And I think it has something to do with foreign trade. And I don't call that a family farm when you got hundreds of cows. It's not a family farm. That's a Wall Street farm.
So, Madeline, bringing up environmental concerns with these concentrated animal feeding operations, these CAFOs, what is the center doing to make sure larger farms are also sustainable?
Well, the main focus of, well, we have three main focuses at our center, and one of our research units is completely dedicated to environmental, studying the environmental footprint of the U.S. dairy industry. That center, that unit is actually based in Marshfield, by the way, more central Wisconsin. And one of our main focuses there is to eliminate or reduce, greatly reduce, the loss of those nutrients that I was talking about earlier. Any loss of nitrogen or phosphorus from the system will result in an economic loss for the dairy producer as well as an environmental problem. So that's a key thing for us to minimize. We also study extensively the risks of pathogens and other impacts on the environment locally. We have a researcher, for example, that extensively studies pathogens in the groundwater and determining the source of those, whether that is from cattle or in some cases it may be from a rural septic system. So, it's a certainly a major issue. And one of the things that we look at is techniques for applying that manure to ensure that it is safely applied and that it doesn't go off site. Injection systems where we put it under the soil surface so that it doesn't run off. Eric Young is a researcher there who's been doing some low disturbance application methods to try to assess the impact of that. So, that's really a primary focus of our research center is to try to mitigate that environmental footprint.
There have been many years of research on these manure digesters capturing methane gas from animal waste. Have you seen technology investment and advancements in these manure digesters?
Yes, there's definitely been some massive changes in that regard in the last several years and across the country and in Wisconsin as well. I know several of our stakeholder members who are dairy producers from Wisconsin have integrated methane digesters in their system. And that has drastically reduced their environmental footprint. And it's also been able to integrate some of that energy production from their own farm and putting that back into their dairy.
Yeah, can you explain how how one works, how a manure digester works?
Yeah, that's a really great question. It's fairly complex, but essentially any manure when setting around and just in general, it would create methane. And if we put it into a chamber, basically, and we set the conditions so that the microbes are able to very effectively convert that manure into methane, we capture that and we can clean it up. And basically then we can consolidate that methane, capture it in concentration, and then be able to use it for energy production or to take off site. That still leaves us with the carbonaceous material, the aftermath of that. It still has some nutritional value for the soil, and then we can add much of that back to the soil.
Digesters can also be very costly, and for small farms, as we've been talking about, a huge investment. Is it a worthwhile investment? Should you go down this road?
Yeah, that's a really tough question to answer because it depends. Depends on a lot of different factors, but generally speaking, you're right. It does have to, for it to really pencil out economically, it needs to be on a relatively sizable operation, unless there's some sort of support coming from either a company-based system or government programs of some sort to subsidize that. There are a number of actual discussions going on in businesses and companies across the country right now about carbon-based economy and trying to give carbon credits to producers for doing such practices. And certainly there's government programs to assist that as well. One, as an example, in California, they have heavily subsidized these types of installations, and they've seen a massive decrease in methane production in their state over the past 5 or 6 years or so.
Dennis Hancock with us, Center Director at the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center in Madison, taking your questions. Are you concerned about methane production on dairy farms? What do you want to know about how small farms and CAFOs operate? What questions do you have about soil erosion or runoff? Join in 800-642-1234. Andrew is joining us from Waukesha. Hi, Andrew. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Two different topics. The first one quickly has to do with industrial hemp. I'm interested if there are any applications for cannabis in foraging. I've heard of some farms that will feed flowers to cows, not as a source of nutrition necessarily, but just as a supplemental for nutrition. And my second question has to do sort of along the digester line, but like using additional systems. In this case, I studied water quality technology. I've always been interested in aquaculture and the research that's being done up in Bayfield, Wisconsin. Are there ways to integrate those closed loop systems? You talked about managing your runoff, and certainly with the digesters, I mean, that's a very, industrial system where you're managing the whole process, but how that could make foraging more sustainable. For example, letting fields lie fallow, but you're still making money because you have an aquaponic system running on a small footprint in that acreage.
And Andrew, great questions here. And I want to make sure we have time to respond. Dennis, kind of a 1-2 punch question. I'm going to have you knock out one first, and then we might have to take the other one on the other side. Go ahead, Dennis.
Sure. Let me try to get the first one in first. The challenge with hemp is that it's still relatively new, and there's still a lot of work to be done on that. There actually is a concerted effort ongoing to really jumpstart a hemp research program. And actually, our sister unit in Lexington, Kentucky, is taking on quite a bit of activity in this area. And in fact, part of that is going to be looking at its role in feeding it to ruminant animals, including dairy cows and beef cows. So there's some work ongoing. Stay tuned. It's still relatively new for us to be able to work on. So hopefully we'll have answers soon.
All right. Agronomist Dennis Hancock leads the USDA's Dairy Forage Research Center based in Madison, taking your questions about using manure as fertilizer, soil erosion, runoff, robotic technologies on the farm. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up and go to part two of Andrew's question after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about dairy production systems, soil ecology, forage health here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center is bridging that gap between academic research and what can be applied on working dairy farms in our state. One example came across developing an app to help dairy farmers reduce expenses and pollution, measuring milk urea nitrogen, which ends up as ammonia in the environment, degrades air quality. What technologies do you think could help farms limit emissions? 800-642-1234. Agronomist Dennis Hancock directs the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center and is with us for the hour. Dennis, following up on Andrew's other question, what is the best use of manure that leaves the least amount of environmental impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, we really like to look at all different opportunities to utilize that source of nutrients. The caller mentioned aquaculture and using some sort of a closed system to use that in producing fish or other types of seafood. And I think there's some merit to that. There are some studies around the country that have looked at that. It's a challenging lift to try to do something like that. It's very expensive, but you know, we focus on trying to utilize that back on the farm itself and to grow the crops and to do so without those nutrients being lost to the environment. So one of the main focuses that we have is integrating that back in, developing application methods to ensure that that stays put, that it actually is utilized by the crop, and looking at our crops themselves and the timing in which we are applying those materials to ensure that we have adequate uptake of those nutrients.
Let's bring in Aaron now in Peshtigo, who's a beef grazer. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Hey, Dennis, I saw your talk on the Grassworks virtual conference. It was very good. You're a good fit for Wisconsin, so I'm glad you're supporting us here.
Appreciate that.
I graze beef cattle up in Peshtigo here, and my former life was as a water and soil researcher for UW Extension. And so I have some bona fides when it comes to dealing with this stuff across the state. And, you know, we spent 10 minutes of this show talking about digesters and different things. And that stuff is fun to talk about and kind of sexy technology, but we already have the answers to how to solve a lot of these soil and water issues with our livestock systems. Rotational grazing is really the answer to solving our manure management issues, our air quality issues, our soil and water quality issues. You know, when that soil is permanently covered in quality pasture, there's no erosion or very little erosion, very little nutrient loss. The soil becomes higher in organic matter. Our very own Wicks trials at UW-Madison have shown that the only cropping system that builds soil organic matter is rotational grazing. My own farm was part of a UW-Madison study by a researcher from Dr. Randy Jackson's lab. In the last 5 years, my soils have gained 50% more organic matter under rotational grazing management than where they started under conventional cropping.
So, what does that mean for your cattle?
Oh, I got grass coming out my ears, Kate. I got my pastures are beautiful. My cattle are fat and happy. And and I feel the wildlife are thriving. And it's a beautiful way to farm. And I can feel good about the fact that I'm having a positive, not a negative impact on my local environment.
Well, let's get some words in here from Dennis. Dennis, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd love to hear those stories of folks who have been able to effect major change on their operation by, you know, implementing best management practices and especially the positive impact on the environment. And I would say probably, too, if we were having back, he would comment about change in his farm family lifestyle, the impact that it's had on him as a farm family as well. So he's absolutely right that there is some major improvements in soil carbon sequestration and good grazing management. One of the studies that I conducted on pasture-based dairy, well, actually several pasture-based dairies in the Southeast United States, we saw every year we would increase a third of a percentage point in soil organic matter on those farms after conversion from cropping systems over to rotational grazing. So it does have a major impact. There are some real challenges, of course, with annual crops as well. And a recent study from one of our sister units in St. Paul, Minnesota, showed, you know, the challenges of carbon loss on some of those annual crop-based systems. So the more that we can integrate in perennial crop systems into our dairy farms, the more we're going to be able to build and sequester carbon in the soil. And we have a concerted effort going on at our center to do just that. We have plant breeders who develop new varieties for that very purpose. In fact, I would guess that many of the farms that the caller was talking about that have integrated those grazing practices are using some of the varieties that came from the Dairy Forage Research Center.
Hmm. Aaron, I want to just ask Aaron here for a moment, you know, that you've put on these good grazing, you know, practices, rotational grazing. What are your next steps? What do you work on next? I think we lost Aaron there. You know, Dennis, you know, in a situation like, Aaron, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, I just wanted to ask you, now that you've put in those rotational grazing practices, really good grazing management, what are your next steps? What do you work on?
Grazing management is always a, there's always room for improvement. I know when I start moving cattle every day, you know, now we're moving cattle twice a day. We're always working on leaving enough residual, trying to get our pastures to be healthier, more productive, trying to build that organic matter, and then spreading the word. You know, I hold field days at my farm every year. My farm has kind of become a living classroom for folks who are interested in learning about grazing. It's my favorite thing to do is to host people out and show them what I'm doing, and hopefully they can bring something home to do on their own place.
What about climate change, Aaron? Have you had any impact from either flood events or drought, adverse weather events impacting how you go about your management practices?
For sure. Yeah. Well, so like 2018, 2019, very, very wet years, very challenging from the standpoint of too much water, trying to keep the cattle from making a mess of the pastures. That's how we actually started moving twice a day, because we were trying to just keep the cows moving so they wouldn't make a mess. And it turned out that was even better for our grass growing. Conversely, this June was extremely dry. We got almost no measurable rain for the entire month of June, which is normally our biggest grass growing month of the year. But the beauty is with these perennial pasture systems is that they're far more resilient to climate change. You know, while people were, conventional dairies and such were breaking equipment, trying to drag chopper boxes through the fields during those wet years, my cows were just going about their business. Their four-wheel drive forage harvesters and manure spreaders I didn't need to start up any piece of equipment to go about my business. And the same thing when it was super dry in June and things were looking crummy, you know, my grass was hanging on because that soil is such a, has turned into such a sponge that there's a lot of water
retaining
stored
it
in that profile.
Yeah. Dennis, what are your thoughts there on these adverse weather events and the practices you look at for retaining soil nutrients?
Well, first of all, I would say I want to get to Aaron's farm. I wanted to check things out
on the double. Yeah.
We have a new scientist at Marshfield specializing in grazing systems and doing research in that area. So really would like to link those two up. But you're absolutely right. In the challenges that are talked about here with climate change and the weather variability that occurs, it's extraordinarily challenging. There's tremendous risk in these systems. And, you know, these producers have a lot of money on the line here. Their livelihoods are literally on the line. And the variability that exists just creates nightmare scenarios. So one of the things that we've tried to do is to provide information about options in a situation where it gets extremely dry or extremely wet, or in the event of a, you know, last year we had the derecho that came through and damaged so much of the crops in the Midwest. What do we do in those situations? And providing some good data-based information to those producers is absolutely crucial. We were able to provide quite a bit of information on novel forage crops, things that we don't normally grow for forage crops, but things that can be grown in a pinch.
Hmm.
And so a lot of our researchers have been able to publish extensively on some of those alternative forage crops.
How problematic are weeds in these fields?
You know, weed control is a major challenge, and actually climate change affects that too. We have seen increased challenges of weed pressure in many pastures and in row crops. In row crops in general, there are tools in place to be able to keep many of those challenges at bay, but especially in pastures, it is much more difficult. And especially on organic operations where the control options are a lot more limited. And I would also point out too, though, that there are some weeds that are actually highly nutritious and those can be grazed. Of course, there are some that are highly toxic and there are some risks there. So identifying the precise weed that one is dealing with is a focal point too.
Dennis Hancock leads the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center, taking the helm last year, formerly led the Sustainable Grazing Systems Program at University of Georgia, conducting research to look at best management practices for pasture and grassland crops. What is your number one pasture management practice? How have you avoided overgrazing and protecting the soil? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring the work of the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center. Thanks to an email from Jennifer, who suggested we connect with the center in Madison that's under the umbrella of the USDA. It's a listener request show. Also, a shout out to Jim from River Falls, Barbara in Marquette County, Becky from Hustaford, Wayne and Clinton, all who wanted to learn more about sustainable ag practices. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Dennis Hancock is Center Director of the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center with us for about 10 more minutes. Dennis, you know, there have been plans for a new dairy research facility in Prairie du Sac. Congress had appropriated money to build one. What is the status there?
Yeah, we're really excited to have this opportunity to rebuild a new dairy for us. You know, our existing research dairy was built in 1979. And, you know, we have gotten the good out of it. We have really utilized it to the full extent. But frankly, it's out of date. It's not in line with modern systems. And frankly, not only, you know, is it not representative sometimes of the dairies that we're trying to model, it's not kept up with the science either. So there are some real innovations that we're trying to build into that. An example of which is some work that we can do to measure methane And we're excited to have that as part of the new dairy research dairy that we're building outside of Prairie du Sac.
What is the timeline for that construction?
Well, we're very much still in the planning phase. We're speccing out everything that we need to have in that new dairy. We should have that plan put together, and the design actually will be done next summer. And then construction will begin in probably in 2023. And the timeline has us roughly about 2025. I'm a little bit more of a pragmatist, I guess. I'm telling everyone 2026. So
okay.
The end of 2026, hopefully we'll have it up and running.
Will it have, you said you're kind of bringing up with the most recent innovations, and, you know, we haven't gotten into really technology and robotics. What does that have as you look at the research across sustainability? How much does technology have here in the dairy system?
Well, technology is absolutely crucial. We see that in our own daily lives, of course. We've seen how technology can increase efficiency in a variety of different circumstances in businesses and, in our own personal lives and being able to keep up with everything that goes on in our lives. But especially so in a system where you're striving to be as efficient as possible. The style of feeding our animals such that we're feeding groups rather than by the individual animal. As an example, with a robotic system, there is a little bit of feed that is fed to each cow as she comes into that robot to be milked. And with animal ID, we would be able to identify that cow. We know how much she's producing. We know where she is in her lactation cycle. We know a lot about that cow. And we may even know her DNA makeup, not only for her, but the microbes that are in her intestine.
Wow.
And we may be able to then feed directly what she needs to be the most productive that she can be.
How do cows take to those robotic milking systems?
They really do like it. It's funny, if you've ever had a chance to go watch cows be milked in one of the robotic systems, they really do enjoy going in there. In fact, in some cases, we program the system so that it will only allow them in certain times of the day and only so many times per day because they do like to go in there and mill about. And plus, every time they go in, they get a snack. So they like that.
Have you seen that technology change as well with those robotic systems and also bringing the cost down?
Yeah, the cost is dramatically reduced over the last 10 or so years that these have been really popular. Like everything from VCRs to iPhones and the like, you know, the price of technology has come down dramatically as we see more and more of those being used. And what I really like about robotics, too, is that it's often in reach of the medium and small size producers who are able to continue dairying in many cases because they have adopted robotics. And I've met with a few of these folks who have been able to, you know, their farm, small farm operations, family operations, the kids aren't coming back, they're struggling to find labor. And that's really a major challenge in the dairy industry, is finding labor, as it is for all other businesses right now, but especially true in dairy. And robots, in many cases, have been able to allow that family farm to keep dairy. So it's a really important part of the future. Some have been more quickly ready to adopt it than others, but it's a major opportunity for the dairy industry.
And we hear how, you know, running a dairy is a 7-day, 24/7 operation. Those cows continually need to be milked. And so robotics able to help kind of ease, I would assume, that burden when a farmer does want to step away or maybe has an issue with a labor shortage.
Absolutely. And that's really the benefit, is that it can keep going with less input from the producers themselves. And if things go wrong, if something happens, if a cow is having some sort of distress, a text message goes to the producer's phone. and tells them that that cow has been sorted out. You need to come look at her, you know, and check her out.
Let's bring in John now in Ferryville. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, Dennis. If I wanted to put in a 1,000-cow industrial-type dairy, what is the gold standard for acreage to spread manure on in order to guarantee zero impact on groundwater and runoff water in the karst region where the topsoils are thin and the permeability of the understory is pretty pretty significant? Just was curious. We don't have a lot of big dairies in our vicinity, but there's a major proposed expansion of a hog facility in southwest Wisconsin that has the potential to contaminate a lot of groundwater and runoff water. And I was just wondering what your thoughts might be about that.
Yeah, let's get that scenario there, Dennis. What would you say?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a hard one because there is a tremendous amount of variability. There is not an answer that I can give that say this is the X number of acres or whatever to be able to make that sustainable. But there are models out there, and there are specialists who can provide that information, setting down with the producer with a very site-specific plan and to work through that so that they can model exactly what's going to happen and be and live within the guidelines. Now, there's no such thing as a zero impact. No matter what we do, there's going to be some impact. We want to try to keep it as insignificant as possible, as low as possible. Anything that we do, though, is going to cause a challenge. Mm. So whatever the design is, it's very site-specific. As he talked about the karst topography, that makes it even more challenging. So a model that really factors that in to ensure no impact on groundwater is crucial. So sitting down with those specialists, UW Extension is a great place to start.
Great resource, yeah.
They really can give and link anyone with the appropriate persons to assist them.
Well, Dennis, we only have a few seconds left, but, you know, you're in the heart of America's dairyland now, in a place where you should be, we think. So what do you see Wisconsin's dairy industry looking like, say, 5, 10 years, 20 years from now?
Well, that's a really challenging question. I think in some ways it's going to be quite challenging, frankly. There are generational shifts that are going on, and people are less likely to go back to the dairy farm. So the labor challenges are going to continue to be an issue. What's really unique about Wisconsin is our processing and the ability to really capture value out of that dairy industry. So really focusing in on that is probably going to be the real key to success going forward.
Dennis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dennis Hancock, is Center Director at the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center on the campus of UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.